Welcome to Unleash the Beast, a podcast about mental health. Great conversations with writers and speakers who share their experience with mental illness and, importantly, how they manage their mental well-being. Over many years, frontline workers, government and health providers have acknowledged a high incidence of social and emotional well-being problems and mental ill health within our First Nation peoples across Australia. The over-representation of Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander people in almost all public health issues is underpinned by many interconnected factors and concerns. Today's podcast is brought together with our host, Michelle Wiersma, Ron Hampton, Charlie Rowe, and Shirley-Ann Gardner, discussing why closing the gap matters and how each of us can actively contribute to the health and well-being of our First Nations people.
Welcome, everybody. Today's discussion is around mind the gap. What is the gap that we talk about when we talk about Aboriginal health?
The gap is the difference in life expectancy, the difference in ability and capacity to access services, which combine to hold back the Indigenous people who might, if they had better access to health services, be able to have a similar life expectancy to those who are other areas in the country.
I've been really astounded by the fact that people don't see closing the gap as anything other than a number, or they're not really sure what the difference is. And I think a lot of people are quite shocked when they actually hear that the Chief Health Officer has reported that in the Darling Downs, the actual gap in terms of years of difference in life, it's 22 years. So an Indigenous person in Toowoomba or the Darling Downs will actually die at an average age of 59 years. They don't even make 60. So we don't have any residential aged care in Cherbourg because there's no one there to fill the beds. So whereas if you're non-Indigenous, you'll live to 81 years.
Gee, that's so shocking, Shirley.
Yeah. So massive difference in life expectancy. Yeah. But a lot of that is not actually related to access to healthcare. It's all the social determinants. It's where if you're born in an area that doesn't have a good school, then how are you going to know to go to university to get a higher qualification? And if your parents move somewhere, it's because often they need somewhere that's got lower rent, so they'll move out of town. All of those impact on children, and 80% of what happens to you is actually, a lot of it is outside your control. It's to do with education.
Yeah, I agree with the education. Like I also agree with what Uncle Ron was saying, that generational stuff, it has an impact. And when you're looking at the stuff that the First Nations people went through, you know, we were only recognised as human beings in 1967. So before that, we were animal and fauna. So the impact of that now, that's still in our Uncle Ron's lifetime, you know. Mm-hmm. And the things passed down generation through generation still has that impact, and that's where the social emotional well-being comes through is, you know, they haven't been taught how to cuddle their child. They haven't been taught how to say, I love you. And the stuff that impacts our mob is that they have no trust in non-Indigenous organisations. Some of them don't even have trust in an Indigenous organisation, let alone a non-Indigenous organisation, because of what their grandparents or parents have been through before them. So education, Shirley-Ann, is a big thing around access to Aboriginal health services, access to non-Indigenous services. So that's what we try and do here at Carbel, and that's what I try and do, is educate everybody that it's important to get their health check and look after their social and emotional well-being.
Aspects is the ability to access culturally appropriate and culturally sensitive health services.
So what we're trying to do is trying to close that gap on that rate. But I think as we go on, we're starting to close that gap in the health side of things, but we just want to try and eliminate that gap where our mob are getting the services that they need, the holistic care around their health, around their comorbidities and chronic disease.
Is that the same for people who live in the city as people who live in other regions or in rural or outback areas?
Yeah, it's right across the whole regional and rural, far as I know.
If you're living in really high-density urban areas where you have much better access to health, the access then varies as you move away from those, so through regional into rural and then into remote. Whether you're Indigenous or non-Indigenous, there is an impact on health and expectancy, life expectancy, and access to particular treatments.
So for the last 4 years I've been running Toowoomba Hospital, but my passions are social determinants of health. And what we do know is that actually only 20% of things related to your health are to do with access to healthcare. We know that your postcode is a stronger predictor of your health than your genetic code. So if you live further out from Toowoomba, for example, you're more likely to have poorer health because of the lack of access to quality healthcare, like you were saying. We can have chemotherapy offered at Toowoomba, but you mean if you live in Cherbourg, have to travel to Toowoomba, and it makes it very difficult for care.
Everything that you've said, does that also resonate for mental health? I'm really keen to get an Indigenous perspective on mental health. What's that like?
Definitely. In fact, mental health in Indigenous communities is much worse across the board. When you look at the suicide rate, you have young people suiciding at an abhorrent rate. And part of that is because of transgenerational impacts of the way in which Aboriginal people have been discriminated against. That impacts on how they interact in a mixed environment, and that then creates a impact on their self-perception. And so we end up with young people seeing no future.
That social and emotional well-being is affected by that social isolation.
Yes.
People feel if you don't feel connected to your community, you'll then have the social isolation. Social isolation, you pull away from services rather than actually go to them.
Yeah.
And that leads to a higher risk of suicide.
Uncle Ron was talking about suicide there and about these young fellows, and they don't know where they come from because they haven't been told. So, you know, I know where my mob comes from is a little mission called Toomla, and I'm connected to there, and that gives me a self of belonging and knowing who I am. And a lot of these kids and fellows these days don't know who they are and where they belong.
That's exactly right, and I think that's one of the biggest barriers to reducing the gap in the life expectancy. If you don't feel you belong, and a sense of belonging. And I think that New Zealand does this very well with the whole social, emotional, physical and family connection. And it's that connection to not only the community but your family. Yeah. And for some people to get ahead in life, if they do recognise that, hey, I've seen on TV people live better than I do, you have to leave your family to go to a bigger city to get those jobs. And for some people when they arrive, not only do they feel that social isolation, but it is worse for Indigenous because there's a lot of racism as well. Mm. And so there's a lot of other things that impact on them, not just moving out of town.
So I wonder then, what are the sorts of things that can be done to improve the outcomes for Indigenous Australians?
My belief is that if we can get our people healthy physically and mentally, they can start making the right decisions for themselves and for their family. So we talk a lot around the mental health. We call it social, emotional and well-being because we don't want to be called Womba or anything, you know. So, it's talking about, you know, what sort of a role model they need to be within themselves, within their family, within the community, and how they get that support through either myself, through the doctors and psychological services and all that sort
of stuff. What Charlie is saying about that lack of understanding where you come from is Aboriginal people were separated from mainstream Australian society. They were put basically into isolated settlements. I remember years ago in WA going to visit the local Aboriginal camp on a wheat belt town, and it was across the railway line and about 5 kilometres away from the city, from the city town. That isolation creates problems for kids who want to attend school or are attending school or expected to attend school. It also means that because people have been isolated from their families traditionally, a lot of the missions prohibited the continuation of local language and local culture and local customs. If you don't have those, who are you?
Shirley-Anne, we were talking earlier about some of the things that New Zealand is doing.
That's exactly right. And I think we're light years ahead in New Zealand. And I'm super proud to be a Kiwi when it comes to the inequalities in health, because there's an active focus on it. And it was a bit like Charlie saying that the Indigenous and Australians weren't recognised as people. The Maori in Australia were recognised as people well before the Indigenous Australians were. So I think that New Zealand, one of the key things they did was recognise the Maori language. The difficulty in Australia is there are so many Indigenous languages, there's not just one. But in New Zealand, to become a kindergarten teacher, you have to learn to speak Te Reo Māori. And it's there's three national languages, English, Sign Language and Maori. So that really helps. And we embrace kurus on our tattoo, you know, tattoos with kurus. We're very big on the embracing culture. And I don't think that we're there yet in Australia embracing culture. And I think we need more empathy and understanding of where Indigenous Australians have come from. And the acknowledgement that it's not the fault of people who live in poverty who don't get out of poverty. We know that 70% of people born in poverty will remain there because you don't know what you don't know. And those that do get out of poverty are normally white. They've gone to university. They come from two-income families and they haven't experienced unemployment. And we know that all that ties into what the social determinants show for Indigenous is,
that's right,
like the problem.
I think, you know, going forward, I think we need to, as First Nations, look at how the Kiwis done it and how they're doing it now. And I suppose when you're looking at language, we got probably 800 dialects, you know, across Australia. So that does make it hard for getting our culture put through schools so people do understand and get educated around our culture. So it's so hard. And we do want, when people are talking about our culture, to be putting it in the right perspective and what it truly is.
Exactly. And New Zealanders don't have a choice, and we're just born embracing different cultures. So Tahirua Toru Fa, the counting, was just what you did when you were little. It was just like a, just like you would 1, 2, 3. We do not see that here, and it would be just great if we embraced more of that, the culture that does exist.
There is a move to introduce local Indigenous languages into schools, but it's difficult to do because there, many of the groups have lost all of their language. And what we need to do really in Australia before we can move forward is we've got to go back, and we have to have a country which acknowledges the whole history of occupation and of discrimination. Once we do that, once we recognise and embrace, I suppose, the fact that Aboriginal people have been here for 60-odd thousand years. They have the longest continuous culture in the world. And yet we don't recognise that, that we don't celebrate.
When we're having a contemporary discussion like what we are about mental health and the real impacts that we see right now, a lot of people are going to say, and a lot of people do say, well, that's just living in the past. As a white person or perhaps an immigrant from another country, it could be from an African country or an Asian country, people say, well, that's really not, you know, I didn't do that. I wasn't participating in that. And there's a lot of thoughts about that, but the question that I think people will have is, well, that's fair enough. Okay, you want to go back to go forwards, but what does that mean to me, and why should I be a part of that?
Oh, well, for me, as an Indigenous person, I think that's where we got to start. We've got to look back and see what's happened to our people, our mob, you know, to our ancestors, our elders that lived through this lifetime of being called an animal and couldn't have their own marriage or bank or go out and work, you know, and having their kids removed because they wanted to breed out our culture, you know. Yeah. Big time, that's what it's all about. We're trying to deal with, we got 30-year-old blokes in our group that don't know how to hug their own child because they haven't been taught that, they were removed. So then you've got the impacts of the drugs and alcohol and whatever else. They think it's a normal thing because that's what they're growing up with, that's what their parents are growing up with. So we're trying, well, I'm trying to change our way of thinking. That's not the normal thing to go and have a charge or a bong, you know, or smack your missus around. It's not the normal thing to do. This is what you need to do is say, I love you, open the door, go and buy some flowers. And if you're doing that to your wife, your children are going to see what you're doing. So they're going to expect to be doing that to their wife. And their daughter expects that. So trying to break that cycle of what
isn't
the normal
thing.
That's
really practical. They're really practical things, aren't they?
They are practical. Yeah. And we take that for granted because we know what they're doing is not the normal thing, but they don't see that. And that's what we're trying to do.
And I think it's really important not to blame people because it's so easy when you've grown up in a family, even if it's domestic violence and you don't know what you don't know. And then when you realise, hey, actually there's a different way, it can be generations before you can actually break that cycle because you're so used to doing things in a certain way.
That's right.
And I think it's not about forgetting the past. It's about using that to say that's shaped who I am.
That's exactly
but right. I'm going to do something different now.
Yeah.
But we need to tell society that we need to be accepting that something's happened here that's led to this. This is not the people deciding to act in a certain way because they choose to.
No.
You don't know what you don't know.
That's exactly right. And that's why we can't be judgmental. We don't know what's happening in these people's lives to get them to where they're seeing us now or Uncle Ron or the health service. So they're presenting to us wanting change and help and support to do that. So that's what we got to do. Don't be judgmental. You know, I hear some of my clients walk into the doctors and the doctor's looking them up and down straight away because they think they're ice users or something. The client just turns and walks away and they're gone.
Yep.
So where do they get the support from then? Mm.
You know? So, Charlie, what can I do as an Anglo woman? I don't have an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background, but I want to help. I want to be a part of this. I want to genuinely impact somehow, or walk alongside. Yeah. How do I do that?
Well, I think if you're going to walk beside us, you need to understand our journey. So by doing that is cultural awareness training. If you're working for an organisation that helps all kind of people, like Indigenous people, well, understand what it is to, when we talk about being culturally safe and culturally appropriate, what does that mean?
What does it mean?
What does that mean to an Indigenous person is, if I going to an organisation, I see Aboriginal flags or paintings on the wall or an Aboriginal face at the front, I feel, okay, they understand my journey and who I'm about, so I'll go in there. If I don't see that and it's, you know, there's nothing there, they may not understand who I am and what I'm coming for. So, you know, having acknowledgement on your reception desk and flags, Aboriginal flag and Torres Strait Islander flags and artwork and I don't know if Uncle Ron wants to contribute to this, but that's what I see. If I walk past Carbo Medical Services or another Aboriginal and I see all that, I'm going to feel like I can go there and that's where I belong. Mm. If they can get me in that door the first time, I'll come back.
It's not just a matter of having artwork, having acknowledgement. What we used to do when I was doing cultural training was to encourage the whole staff to be embracing, to be, you know, open and accessible. If you don't, if you have all the trimmings and you don't have that capacity to interact on a personal basis, you're not succeeding. Now, I know we see a lot of politicians on the TV with Aboriginal artwork in the back.
I've seen that. Right?
Yeah, but often that's just a little bit of window dressing.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's tokenistic. And, when I first came into my role, I saw that there was organisations that wanted me to go and have cultural interactions with them and get them to understand. And if they're only ticking the box for the government to say they've had an Aboriginal face come out and do it, I don't like doing it. They need to embed it into their organisation that they're embracing our culture. Yeah.
I think embrace the culture, and there's a really good saying that I love, which is don't judge me by the chapter of my life you happen to walk in on. Yeah. And it's see everyone the same at face value, and don't look at
I'm just going by my own personal
experience, actually. My grandfather was quite abusive, and my father then tried to break the cycle, but it was difficult. And then I know that I realised, actually, my dad was trying really hard, but some things are ingrained. So then I tried to do that with my daughter when I realised when she was born, I was following some pretty bad, making some bad choices based on how I grew up. And it's that's why I know it takes generations to actually realise this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. And I think role models are really, really important. Looking, and if you see someone doing something else, you think, oh, actually, this isn't right. And that's why I think it's generational, because actually sometimes when you grow up with something, you wouldn't know any other way. You need someone else to show you a different way.
And it is generational. And for lots of Aboriginal people, especially, you know, Aboriginal mothers over generations, they have not had those role models. They've been separated. So, you know, they don't learn parenting skills. They're not able to pass them on to their children. And we get that impact, which then impacts on their social and emotional and mental well-being.
And I think that you can all speak into this, but there is some clear understanding around and research around the fact that the makeup of the home and the way that it's set is actually one of the key social determinants of health for all populations, but absolutely and most certainly for Indigenous and First Nations populations as well. And I think perhaps you've got some insights on that, Shirley, and I think the rest of the panel would definitely be able to have some personal insights and some stories to tell about that as well.
Yeah, and we do know that hardwired into your DNA are certain emotions, and you have to learn the others. You have to learn empathy. You have to learn forgiveness. You have to learn things like that. They're not something that you're born with. So if your parents don't teach you certain emotions or how good it to be happy, you won't learn those. They're learned traits, not embedded in. So there's a really great kids movie, and it's called Inside Out, and it's about the emotions in a kid's head. But those are the emotions you're born with. Everything else you have to learn. And it goes through, you know, the emotions of this girl. But I like it because it basically does explain that if you do not learn right from wrong, then that's something you have to learn. You're not born with that. It's your parents teach you those things. So that's why young parents really do need some sort of role model, and the stuff that, Charlie, you're doing at Kabul sounds fantastic, because otherwise you won't know that. And we do know that if you're born into a higher socioeconomic family, your parents will speak to you three times more with a vocabulary three times more than those in poverty. And it's just simply education.
If we're talking about role models for Indigenous children and Indigenous communities, one would immediately think, well, absolutely, we need to have Indigenous role models to do so. And I think that that makes perfect sense. However, we're going to have a number of listeners that are non-Indigenous. And I wonder, what part do they play, if any, in that role modelling process as well?
Within the Strong Fathers group, I talk a lot about role models for these guys. And what I want to try and do is talk about who they looked up to growing up as a child. Why do I ask them that? Because I want to find out what traits their role model had, if they were good traits or if they were bad traits, and why they really did look up to them. So if they got really good traits, why these guys looked up to them as a role model, they should be implemented into themselves so their kids have their dad as that role model. That is a good thing. You know, they might be their dad or whoever they pick, Uncle Ron, might be, you know, my role model, because he's on boards and he works hard and he understands and he's there for me and all that sort of stuff. So getting, it's not just about asking him why they looked up to him, but indulging more because of those traits. We need to bring those good traits out. I looked up to my father and uncle. My father not so much as being a good dad, because he was an alcoholic, he was a very abusive, but what he taught me to work on cars, backyard mechanics, I still have that today, even though he's been gone for 10 years. But my uncles, you know, both sides of family, white and black, they were really good because they got out and worked hard and done all that sort of stuff. So that's what I want to give my kids, showing my kids how I respect my uncles and my elders, and not only on the Indigenous side but white side, you know, non-Indigenous side. So, yeah.
By engaging with you know, kids in general, and you'll find that you know, a lot of Aboriginal kids will look into sport, and they can then pick up really good role models from some of the coaches and people engaged there. But Charlie was talking about traits, and I think also about trades. You mentioned sort of a trade there. I can remember, and I won't give his full name, but Uncle Ray, who was, you know, part and parcel of our community, and who was always saying that he was the first qualified carpenter builder. You know, now, when you find a group of people who can say, I was the first to be able to do this trade. If you look into the non-Indigenous community, you won't, unless it's a new trade, you won't find anyone who can say that.
We were talking earlier about language and how important language is. How do I learn some of our local languages? I know about Jarawa and Kayabal people and the Waka Waka people as well. I'm wondering, how do I learn the language? Who do I talk to?
You've got to find somebody.
Who?
And that's the most difficult part.
Yeah.
Because most of our languages across the whole of Australia have lost the capacity to speak language. And sometimes they're working hard to revive a language. But unless you're in remote areas of Australia, you won't find many speakers of traditional language.
So if we were to take a leaf out of New Zealand's book and start teaching the local people here in Toowoomba a few words, how would we go about that?
So it comes down to individuals, I think, Uncle, that want to pick that up and really bring it back to the fore that our languages are still here and we're just trying to work through and find them.
Yeah. I know in New Zealand, growing up in the late 70s and 80s going to school, when language of the Indigenous in New Zealand wasn't as we didn't have everyone speaking it every day, and they've really worked hard to do that. So what they did was a lot of storytelling. So we'd hear the myths about how Maui came and all of that. And I wonder if that's a step where you tell all the symbolism that you've got and what it means. Because I know that when I'll say to someone, oh, the Kayabal symbol's really cool, and they'll say, oh, well, that actually means this and this colour means that.
Yeah.
That would be a great start for helping people understand the importance of and what it means. Because you may not have the language, but you've got the culture. Mm. So I think that would be really good, because I know a lot of the totem poles we put up at Toowoomba, we had some local artists do different designs on them, but they all had different symbols, different meanings of what it meant to the artist. But we don't know about that until we ask.
And that's right, yeah.
And one of the things about Aboriginal art is that traditionally it's not a piece of art. It's a mnemonic, a way in which you remember things. And so it describes a particular belief, a particular story of traditional, or rather the ancestors. Or it might be something which describes how you live on the land, how you move from one place to another, and that encompasses your country. So
story.
It is symbolic.
Storytelling and song lines, yeah.
Yeah. And until we are, as a nation, we have lots of books which are based on traditional Aboriginal stories about how, you know, the emu lost his wings and things like that. And they are embraced by the young kids.
So what I want to do is create that ripple effect, you know, with the men coming through, that they make that change and then they go home and do it to their brothers or uncles or things like that, and the kids start seeing it. So why I say that is, with our cultural and language, we've got to have that a ripple effect too, because we're losing our uncles, you know, and a lot of them don't want to talk because they're too ashamed, or because they've been brought into not saying the Indigenous from generations beforehand. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to talk about the Aboriginality or whatever. So it's very hard, and we've got to take it onto ourselves, like Uncle Ron, like myself, like these other guys I was talking about, and learning it and bringing it out and pushing it out to where we need to push it.
And that's the stuff that we want to know. You know, how can we make change? What is it that we can all do? And that's a really practical way of doing that.
It is.
And Charlie's been doing this for some time and had some marvellous results. And it's changing attitudes. It's changing the way in which people see themselves. And that's the important thing.
But otherwise, and just on that, I'm skirting it up again, but it also changes attitudes that other people see them, the non-Indigenous, and that gives them pride and confidence that, hey, they are seeing me as a human being, and I'm having my own voice now. So thank you, Unc.
Yeah. Look, I grew up white, or as white as you can be. Yeah. I grew up in, you know, white society, and, you know, you never talked about, you know, who you were. Mm. I didn't actually get, you know, to acknowledge, you know, my ancestors until, you know, I was in my 50s.
That's why this is the best generation to live in. We're wanting change. Yeah. We want to embrace different cultures, I think. Yeah. And if you don't have a role model that's in your family, because some people have no one that actually they look up to, that's where you can look to books and people on TV and everything like that too.
I do a lot. That's where your sports heroes come in, doesn't
that's
it?
Right. Yep. Yeah. I do a lot of it. Sorry.
And your actors, you know, you look at Aaron Patterson at the moment, who's doing a series on Australia. And you look at some, you know, Deborah Mailman and others. You know, sort of, they are changing the way in which Indigenous people are perceived.
Actually, music's another way that listening to Indigenous music or the didgeridoo and the story behind some of those songs, that is amazing. Because in New Zealand there was a song, Poi'ea, which made the top, I think in the 80s it was number one. And it's the most amazing song. And that really brought to the forefront the culture of New Zealand as well, because you had the Pātea Māori Club singing it. And I listen to it on my Spotify every week. It's amazing because I'm really proud. I'm not a Māori, but I'm proud to be a Kiwi. And I'd love to see Australians say, I'm not Indigenous, but I'm proud to be Australian.
And I think that the idea of listening to music and music as a form of expression of young Indigenous people actually leaning into rap and R&B to express their feelings, their concerns and their ideas around their own culture. And that's really good. But also Australia experienced the same thing in the 80s with Treaty, the song, which was by Yothu Yindi, and it was incredible. And I remember growing up in school and everybody was singing that song. And it was a great way to give voice to Indigenous people. But it is something that we don't do as much to celebrate, and it would be good to see more of that take place.
If you think about Aboriginal songs, one that always springs to mind is From Little Things, Big Things Grow. Some of the other songs also give you a poignant view of how people feel. And people, Aboriginal people, often don't feel comfortable in, you know, white society.
So we need to get into some of the Aboriginal groups, you know, singers, songwriters, and really promote their music. Is that one way that we can we can make a difference?
I think walking together too, Michelle,
that's
the way you're going to make a difference.
Because
we do a lot, well, I do a lot behind the scenes for the mob, like meeting with police and child safety and educating them around what's his complex needs are and all that. And talking about suicide and all that sort of stuff, I go to high schools and maybe talking about healthy living, but the last 10 minutes all around social, emotional wellbeing, mental health. And if they haven't got that rock or role model in their life where they can go and talk, I usually hand out my card and, you know, these guys got to have somebody.
Yeah. Mm.
Fantastic. Thank you. Shirley-Ann, can you comment on what the hospital is doing to address the gap?
Oh, we've got a fantastic Indigenous health team led by Risha Lacey, and she's now an executive on the health service. So I think it's just good having someone to go to if we need to talk about it. But like what we can do more, but we're looking at artwork and things like that. But it's not, like you were saying, the artwork. It's the story behind the artwork, and I'd just love to see more of that around Toowoomba Hospital. And just, we have 10% of our admissions are for Indigenous people, even though they make up 6% of the population. So they are absolutely overrepresented in admissions into hospital. But I'd love to see more culturally appropriate services. So, for example, that every person coming in, they've just introduced that every Indigenous person coming in sees an Indigenous liaison officer. And I think that's really, really important. Yeah, because their needs are different to ours. And just to feel that support so that if they're thinking, I can't stay in here, I don't feel safe, it's too foreign an environment for me, they can call on that person and that person can help talk them through what's going to happen to them in a better way than what it would be if they weren't there.
I sit on the Mental Health Review Tribunal for people who are on involuntary treatment orders. And we have also the Indigenous mental health workers, and they are very important for our mob who end up in that situation. Unfortunately, sort of, we don't tend to have enough. but they can be there really as a major support and can change people's attitudes to the treatment that they're getting.
So for Indigenous people who are fronting up to hospital, who are fronting up to mental health services, they should be able to just ask if there's an Aboriginal person there that they can talk to.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that would go a long way in closing the gap and keeping people at hospital where they need to be.
And giving them the phone number and the support person they can call on at any time to come and help them, because it's a scary place to be in hospital, and it's scary in terms of the expectations people have of being able to speak in quite difficult language to explain a condition. And we know that what happens in hospital is people only remember 50% of what's been told to them because of all the nerves and anxiety. Would be even worse if someone actually felt really out of their comfort zone. So they can have someone speak to them in very easy to understand ways about what's happening to them and what's going to happen to them next, and link them then back into the community to Kabul or Goulburn
Like you say, it's that follow-up stuff after they're released too. Making sure that the medication, they understand that they get on newer medication or whatever. So it's that link.
And I know that there are difficulties with the Indigenous health workers in so far as they don't have currently that capacity to follow up outside the hospital. And maybe the organisation needs to change and look at providing that after discharge service.
Well, we're actually looking at employing a vulnerable communities person who can help link to all the community groups, because as you may be aware, we work in silos a lot. And so the hospital is very much, we care for people in hospital and we will keep them and then we'll send you home. And just send you home and expect you will find out the services. What we're trying to do is link up so that we know that we could send an Indigenous person to Kabul and that they can offer X, Y, Z, and if they need support, they can come back. So we'll have that role in place early October.
That sounds like a really good plan for every single one of us, I think, to make ourselves aware of what Indigenous services are out there so that we're ready and prepared. You know, if somebody's coming to us, they're feeling like they're not doing okay, you know, what can I, as a non-Indigenous person, do? I can make sure that I know where they can link. Bottom line is, I guess, that if we're going to see a change in statistics, we need to acknowledge the gap that it's more than numbers. It's a heck of a lot more than numbers. If I think about the things that we've talked about today, it's about making it personal. It's about making an effort to engage, to learn more, to listen more. And one of the best ways to change our national story is to listen to the Indigenous stories, to learn about Indigenous Australian history and to lean into the change. And the most important is this, don't be judgmental.
That's
Yeah.
We're all part and parcel of Australia. Yeah. While some of us have been, our ancestors have been here longer than others, we're all boat people.
Yeah. Thanks, Ron. What an awesome way to finish. Thank you, Charlie Rowe, for your time. Really, really great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron Hampton. Brilliant to have you as part of the team.
Thank you.
Shirley Ann Gardner, some brilliant work being done by the hospital there. And thank you for sharing what you're doing and now and what you're planning to do in the future.
We unleashed this conversation along with many more that have been recorded in Toowoomba, some part of the 2018 Unleash the Beast live event, others from our armchairs as we navigate the new normal in 2020. It is Lifeline Darling Downs and Southwest Queensland's contribution to the national conversation about mental health. If this conversation raises any concerns for you, please don't hesitate. Contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. You have been listening to Unleash the Beast podcast, proudly supported by the David McTaggart Family Foundation.
This Unleash the Beast podcast is sponsored by Harvey Norman Toowoomba, proudly supporting local community during good times and hard. Harvey Norman is there to help you keep in touch with friends and family and continue the important discussions.